My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hello, everybody. This is Pin, and I'm a venture investor at Lightspeed Ventures Partner. Welcome to my show. This is a mini series that will explore the challenges and best practices of venture building in emerging markets through conversations with leading investors and founders across India, China, and Southeast Asia. Today, I'm super excited to have James Mee, founding partner of Lightspeed China, a leading China-focused venture investment firm with over $2 billion under management. His early stage investments include listed companies like Meituan, Pinduoduo, Baidu, and he ranks number 21st on 2020 Forbes Global Top 100 VC Midas list. James also served as a head of Asia product at Google and spearheaded Google's early efforts into China. James, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Ping, for having me.
Excellent. James, you have a fascinating story moving from a venture founder to, company builder for a mega tech company to now founding your own venture investment firm. Wanted to, maybe really just go back to your story a little bit. How did all of that happen? How did the moves happen?
It's a little bit accidental. So I was really the first person building Google China from ground up. And I built the legal entities and getting the license for Google in China and responsible for all the products and the strategies. With that, I really felt that China is such a big market and there are many promising areas in internet space that with Google's technology, potentially we can do, but fundamentally, I think the local company has a better advantage. So I picked early stage team companies and proposed to Google to make equity investment. At that time, Google doesn't do any minority equity investment at all globally. Even today, now you have a Google Venture, Google Capital, Capital G. At that time, there's none what was in existence. But fortunately, I got support from Larry Sergey and Eric Schmidt, and we made those investments. And it certainly turned out to be a fantastic return for Google as well, and also helped Google strategically. But one thing interesting was all these founders came to me and said, "You're just very different from other venture investors." They loved it because I did my own startup before Google. And building Google China from scratch also is building a startup. They feel that they got a lot of help and very valuable help. And I really enjoyed it, helping them as well. So I felt that this is something I really can do for the rest of my career. So I moved on and joined the Lightspeed as a global partner initially. Later on, founded Lightspeed China and do this all full-time professionally. In terms of what to learn and unlearn compared with doing professionally VC and strategic investment, I think certainly I need to learn how to build a fund and make sure the investment, not just on individual company level, but overall fund portfolio, how to build it and maximize the return for the fund and through all these exits. These are very, very important. But there are certain elements, I think, investing as a strategic investor, I think there are some elements looking beyond the financial matrix, the financial returns, but thinking the core value for the products, for the users, and meshing with the trend in the industry. Those elements, I think, still extremely valuable. And so those are kind of the thinking. we had.
I want to touch a little bit on kind of interesting product that you felt Google couldn't build and that you were in a much better position to invest in because now that you have your own fund. Any examples?
So one investment I did at Google was Dianping. Dianping is like, they started similar to Yelp, user-generated restaurant reviews, and they started actually before Yelp, eventually evolved into group buying and all the other services that relates to restaurants and the service companies. Initially, when I made the investment, the company didn't have any revenue. And now today, they merged with Meituan almost equally. It's over $250 billion market cap, including a lot of the on-demand food delivery service. So looking back, right, in when I made an investment, the company have zero revenue. And it's unsure about how they make money. But one thing I really feel strongly that there's a tremendous value they are building that it's difficult for Google with its own resources and the technologies. It's very difficult to catch. So this is really, because I run all the products, there's one element for user-generated content for a restaurant is not many people realize. My theory was Chinese people love to eat, and this relates to a lot of Asian people. But for people who really love to eat, not many people are willing to spend time writing the review. They are all too busy, right? So it's a much smaller percentage of the people who love to eat and love to write. And where do they write? They usually will prefer a platform that has most viewers. Right? So that kind of network effect, Dianping started, has built initial momentum, and this is the place people feel that I have the most viewers, and so people willing to write over there. That advantage, actually, it's difficult for Google, even we have all the resources, to be able to say, hey, we spent a lot of money and I tried to recruit writers, and it's just not easy. So that's my theory at that time. And I kind of took it to the extreme. I felt that every market, literally every country, eventually has own winner. There's no second player because eventually everybody just say, this is the biggest market review site. I'll just do over there. So that was a thesis, which I put the money in the company. But also I at that time, the smartphone, iPhone was not in existence. This was back in early 2007. But we kind of knew the smartphone mobile internet is coming, given we know the industry very well. So once mobile internet is available, the location-based information like the restaurants and it's extremely more valuable. Now looking at, it's still the only site, even Alibaba has spent a lot of money and tried to catch up, and there's no second player. And if you look at the US market, Yelp is still kind of a predominantly the restaurant reviews, and Google has tried many times and they tried to compete given the map, users and everything else, but still Yelp is by far the largest site.
Excellent. That's a great example of picking a business with huge network effect. I want to switch gear a little bit, James, because so much of venture investing is actually about really picking the team, right? And what do you think, you know, what is your philosophy in picking a team in emerging markets?
I think it's very, very important. And you, it depends on what business they are in. And if it's a social network business, I wouldn't put any background or pedigree, say, hey, you have to fit this profile. It usually doesn't work. We usually look at the early data and see if there's a sign that the product actually is taking off. And the founder could be very different. It could be very much introvert because the person has such a need to express themselves, right? But in most cases, I would say the founders, we lack the founder high integrity and has a very strong capabilities in the areas they are pursuing. If they have some matching experience and can help their endeavor in the startup, that would be helpful. And another thing we look at is very critically is the growth mindset, whether they can learn and be open-minded, but still make their own decision. So in the conversation, we will say, hey, we have some ideas, and some founders just, no, I'm not interested, right? Mm-hmm. Others, they will listen, but they may not just take your advice on the face value. They will think about it. So we observe that. And so that leads to what they are today could be very different where they will be in 2-3 years. If they have the strong growth mindset, they can grow, they can iterate, they can improve on a much faster feedback loop.
Right.
That's very promising. And sometimes we look at the person, this is much more mature and capable than his current age. Mm-hmm. That usually is an indication he has learned a lot and improved quite a bit. And on whether the person has willingness and a capability to build a team and have that leadership skill, it takes more than just a person. It takes a village.
Any quality that's specific to teams in emerging markets, you think?
I think it's one aspect for the emerging market is the professional talents for the middle management or other CXOs.
Yeah.
The talent pool is much smaller compared with Silicon Valley. Mm. And the culture-wise, these professional managers may not be willing to take the risk. So you might end up having a founder, maybe just another one co-founder. So,
right.
So they really miss another CTO or sales head. That's very common. So you can't get a perfect combination of the team initially.
Right.
So we are willing to take that risk. And usually we spend a lot of time helping them to hide these CXO, the missing pieces initially. But it's important for the CEO to be able to say, hey, these are the important executives that I need to hire. I'm willing to give stock option. And I'm willing to spend the time and convince them to join. And if they don't have that capability, it's hard to build a team.
Right. Oh, it's excellent. James, that is a question for you. Many companies, you know, headquartered in the US, often with a lot of money and capital and talent, right, have found limited success building for emerging markets. What do you think those teams or companies have overlooked?
I think fundamentally, the market is different from, say, US market or European market, right? As you know, building a startup is not easy. So you need to have a deep understanding of the market. Also, iterate very fast because any good ideas, there are many competitors. So the challenge for the successful US or European international companies, and it's not as easy to find a leader in the local market who is capable but also entrepreneurial. But I think usually the handicap is even that they found the person and the person can suggest these localization strategies, iterate very fast, but the code base is still in US.
Right.
It's very difficult to fork the coding system and create a very different product. You want to leverage what you have successfully, right? So the time zone difference and the communication and the getting the support from the headquarters and the getting down to the point that the engineering team supports you to build these very, very different system while you still mesh with your central system, that takes much longer time. And the time is critical.
Right. That is true. So you can't really scale that code base.
And another element, I think initially a lot of the successful US companies felt that their US success actually duplicates very, very well in Europe. In other English-speaking or Western language countries, and but China and other Asian markets, India, Southeast Asia, are very, very different culturally and the demographic and the income level is very different.
Yeah.
But sitting in the Silicon Valley or New York, they don't have that kind of a feel, right? So my suggestion, get the founders come over to Asia. It's difficult during COVID, but that's what I did. I brought Larry Sergey to China back in 2004. We have an entourage of all the executives, right? Once they they saw China firsthand, they know it's totally different. So we were able to do something dramatically different from what we did in US.
Interesting. So you made, James, what many would consider pretty contrarian bets into, you know, over the lifetime or your time at Lightspeed. Some examples include investing into Pinduoduo at the peak of traditional e-commerce dominance by firms like Taobao, JD Mall. How did that happen and what were you actually thinking?
I think Pinduoduo, the biggest factor for me to invest certainly was the founder, Colin. I knew him for 14 years. He was he joined shortly after I joined Google, and he was an engineer, but he just impressed with me that he's probably the only engineer or few initially came to me say, I would like to learn how to do products chat with me about a lot of things beyond the traditional engineering work that he's doing. So he has a really kind of a desire to learn, but he's very, very thoughtful. Before he started the Pinduoduo, he had two other companies that relates to e-commerce. And so he came talk to me saying, hey, I'm thinking about doing a third startup and would like to do a company with a bigger impact. And so we brainstormed the different ideas. And but I think the contrary point of view, I'm never shy away from, hey, there's very big incumbents. And Alibaba, JD are already in existence. Maybe one experience I had was previously was a Google experience. Mm. And I was actually given an offer to join Google back in 1999. And when they were just less than 30 employees, well, I was given an offer, but I really wanted to do my own startup. So I turned them down and went off did my own startup. At that time, I think very few VC actually is interested in investing in another search engine companies, right? There you have Yahoo, Excite, and many others. Why you need another search engine, right? So similar thinking, and people always overlook. But that's the amazing thing. It's a garage company can come up with something very different. Pinduoduo is the same. And at that time, Colin and I would really feel strongly that Taobao is actually, the growth is slowing. There is a lot more cost for them to acquire users. But where the users are spending time, WeChat, right? Mm. Tencent is competing with Alibaba. Alibaba can leverage the traffic over there. And so that kind of how do we build a system, an e-commerce system, leveraging the social network traffic, that's critical.
And that's also super local phenomenon, right? Spending time on the chat.
That's right.
Excellent. More generically, any, you know, best or your favorite growth stories in emerging markets, as you see a lot of these founders grow their businesses in China, you know, cross Pinduoduo, Meituan?
Yeah, I can, in the Dianping Meituan case, I can give you one example that people can think about. So when I invested in Dianping, and they started the Yelp business before Yelp, but also evolved with the group buying. Groupon, and Meituan was competing with them at that time. Mm. And so Dianping was focusing on the tier one cities, has the highest income per capita. But Meituan really started in the second, third tier cities. It's a little bit contrarian because if you really want to think about the maximum value for group buying and you want to go after the users really have the money to spend, right? But Meituan really, I think, is smart, and it's difficult to compete with Dianping initially to win the market in the first tier cities. But the second, third tier cities, Dianping really didn't pursue. They want to win the first tier city first. But going after these 200 cities in the third, second, and third tier, the cost is very low because there's no competition. But once you establish your presence, it's much harder for Dianping to come over and capture the market. That's one example when you think about strategy. It's like fighting the battle. Where are you sending your troops, right? And you want to have maximum firing power in the battleground that you have the good chance to win and you can secure those markets. But many other growth hacks, examples, and the Pinduoduo, I think, is really... One, we started actually with selling fruits on internet, leveraging the WeChat group. And they quickly become the number one. But there's one element we decided, actually, you can continue to build that, but we decided to actually become a platform company, not really become fruit or fresh goods, kind of vertical e-commerce. That we definitely can be the number one. It's a very big market, but... intentional decision, it was the marketplace actually is more powerful. So we give up that business and give the business to our competitor.
Interesting.
But creating that platform, the competitor rely on Pinduoduo to get the social traffic, right? And then they expanded to other categories. Now the rest is history. That it becomes one of the largest and user-based e-commerce company now.
Switching gears again to portfolio management and helping out your portfolio company, what do you think is your superpower when it comes to helping emerging market founders?
I can give some examples. There's a company, we invest in consumer internet, enterprise SaaS services in the deep tech space. And there's a company in the autonomous driving, which is, we think it would be a very big market. And then they do a deep tech product called LiDAR, a laser-based radar, a company called Hesai. Mm. So I made an early investment, I led a Series B in the company. And after that, I think there are multiple things. It's a young company. The founder today is a 35-year founders. And at that time, the thesis I had was, it's a big market, there will be a winner in China. And I picked the one that I think has the best chance. But I really talked to them. I said, the other deep tech company I invested, I helped them to build, eventually become the world number one leader. Because deep tech product, if you're really good, you can sell globally. So they actually studied in the US, worked in the US, came back to China. So they share the same vision. So helping them to become the world leader took a lot of efforts, and including strategy-wise, and the what product should we focus? So we started with the highest-end product for robo-taxi. Later on, I reminded them that there's an emerging trend for electrical battery-based EV cars like Tesla. China now is really taking off, and all these EV cars are going to have computer-aided assisted driving, not a full-blown self-driving. So on a highway, you can take your hands off the wheel, the car drives for you. You can switch lanes. And so Ping, you may not have seen that, but in China, this is really big. There are multiple companies, and like NIO is a $60 billion US dollar market cap company in US, and they're one of the many EV car companies have that capability. But everybody needs a LiDAR to enhance the security and to provide even better experience. So I give them the suggestion that not only we should target the highest end, but also these EV car related LiDAR that requires much lower price point. And it needs solid state semiconductor chip technology instead of traditional mechanical spinning LiDAR.
Interesting.
So these strategic decision, helping them to set the stage and get ready when the growth starts, is very, very important because it takes time to develop product. And the other thing was they really become a very, very big player, not only in China, but in US. Today, they are number one. And all the major autonomous driving companies and are using their product. Then there's an established player started suing them. And so there's a pretty stressful time, and but we believe in our technologies. So I personally spent time in helping them fighting the lawsuit. I even flew to US and work with them with the lawyers, and even look at the patents and helping them on deciding on the strategies. And but the result was actually the other party actually decided that they don't want to pursue the lawsuit because they don't think they have a chance to win. So eventually we reach a commercial agreement, and I think that it could potentially be a win-win situation. Then we could pave the way for filing the IPO. So, and also on the fundraising side, and LiDAR, there are a lot of players. So other VC or PE funds may not have the deep insights on the deep technology. And I studied physics undergrad, and I studied electrical engineering at Princeton, and did chip design at Intel. So I'm a kind of a rare breed, kind of a build internet business at Google, but also can invest in these deep tech companies. But in the Series C round, actually, we didn't get any offers from really reputable VC or PE fund. So I actually led the Series C. again, which is unusual, right? Usually did early stage and the next round you leverage other capital, but we had such a strong conviction. And the company also revenue grew 4 times during that time. So we led the Series C, and now they just closed another round. We announced yesterday the $300 million round. And this time, a lot of the top funds didn't get any allocation. So once you establish your leadership position globally, everybody realized. But before that, as an investor, if you have deep conviction, and we actually are not shy away from backing them all the way up to the final destination.
Excellent story. You played their product strategist, you played their lawyer, you played their patent, and you played their patent advisor, and then you played their financier. Cool. James, we've come full circle, and I want to, you know, go back to your first answer about learning to build a emerging market venture fund, right? Learning to manage a fund. You've built Lightspeed pretty much from zero. What is your leadership philosophy in building out a world-class investment team?
I think coming back from experience, over 10-year experience working in Silicon Valley and also at Google, I feel that the culture is very critical. Certainly, we want to hire people with all the qualities, but the firm culture, I think we also, is consistent with Lightspeed, kind of the global culture, is very much we want to build a team and a structure that the capable young investors, they have a platform and they can really be supported. And given the capital, they can invest and get a mentorship and they can grow. And they are recognized, given the credit, and eventually they can rise up and to the most senior level with the original founders. So that culture is, I think it's very much important. It's part of the, we also, Lightspeed China, and I also really emphasize the sharing culture. We share the credit and share the resources. It's not just one person, like, this is my deal. And we want to help each other at any time we need it. And economically, we share that. Even our office manager has a carry, which is not many in China, but our success had actually contributed by all the team members. And and the other thing is we really emphasize being intellectually honest, that everybody, we always have our blind spots, right? And so we want our team members to give us the feedback. But when we also emphasize we can take risk, we have a silver bullet. Even you don't get any of the IC member support, a VP still has a silver bullet. And do pull the trigger, but it's one fund. You have one bullet,
one bullet.
Yeah, but the bullet potentially could be recycled, and if it's turned out to be good, and you can use it again, and for that one fund. And so we know the best companies usually they are very disruptive, and they could be very controversial, and not every team members has the insight or spending enough time. The deal lead is actually very critical. So we kind of build that trust. We're willing to take the risk, but keeping the bar very high and helping each other to think about the critical issues. So that's some of the examples for kind of the culture aspects.
That's really nice. Last question for before we hit the short answer and question part of this podcast. What advice would you give to young investors?
I think venture investment is a long-term business, right? In the average time from a Series A when a company started to IPO usually takes about 7 years, and many failed, right? Mm-hmm. So I would look at it as it's a long term, it's a marathon. And so the more you build the different skill set experience actually will help in the long run. I think many of the very smart young people, and they're very good in getting to the venture very early after the school. I think that's great. I also seen, I have give recommendation to my team members and who took that path. And somewhere in the middle, if you have invested a company actually is doing very well, or your portfolio company, you really feel strongly that they are doing well, spend some time with the company. Take some time off. It doesn't have to be a full-time takeoff, but just going into the company, be the assistant with the CEO and go to every meeting he's going to and think through all these strategic decisions and operational decisions. And so you really get more experience in the startups and you have much better perspective instead of sitting across the table and giving suggestions. And but you know, actually in the trenches, it's very, very different, right? So that experience will help.
Oh, that's a really, really good one. I haven't heard that one before. Cool. James, last three short question and answer. One, what makes a great VC investor?
I think a strong curiosity and willingness to be a lifelong learners will be very helpful. The areas we invest, the opportunity set changes, and you never are the expert on every subject, right? But be able to learn very, very fast. And also, I think it's maintain your independent thinking. That's critical. And very important is keeping a growth mindset. That applies to both investors and founders, and investors that can really benefit from that.
Right. What advice do you have for innovators in emerging markets?
I really admire the founders, and I think they already took all the risk. I think one advice I would always give is it would take 5 to 7 years even to hash right. out these ideas, right? And you might pivot during the process, but you have already made a decision to do a startup. So pick the biggest market segments. And you might start small, but all the time, the most valuable thing we have in our life is time. And you're going to spend 5-7 years on this startup journey. And you might start thinking that this is the market I want to attack. But even think if you can expand that, or sometimes you pivot to something else that can leverage your experience, and but it's a much bigger market.
Right.
By all means, that you should consider that.
Think big. Awesome. How do you stay sharp, and what book or podcast or blog inspire you?
I do some meditation. That helps on the older meetings and keep more calm. And I try to do the most intellectually challenging things in the morning. I make sure I have all the sleep I need, and the quality of decision is more important than the amount of work I do. But we are super busy, so make sure we get all the sleep we need and the exercise we need. I tend to be always very, very curious, and I'm a ferocious reader. That helps us to always think ahead. For early stage investment, we tend to be always a little bit earlier on the new emerging trends. So nobody is telling you that, right? And so that's something you always read and synthesize, and connecting the dots and imagining what's potentially will happen. And so that's also a fun part for it.
Excellent. Thank you so much, James. I think we've come to, you know, the tail end of the show. Really, really grateful to have you here. And thank you for really pulling back the curtains on so many aspects of your work for all of us. Thank you again for spending the time with us.
Thank you, Pin.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.